We're nearly through the second full day of our practice together. And we discover in this exploration that energy comes and goes. Sometimes it feels like there's a lot of energy. Sometimes it feels like there's not so much energy. And in particular, in these first couple days, often there's a low energy, a kind of a low energy experience, the swamp, the mire. And so I'd like to explore with you this evening, this afternoon, this quality of energy. Energy is one of these 10 perfections. And in the list of the paramis, it lies between wisdom and patience. And this is an interesting location for energy. The kind of traditional teaching around the paramis, while it's understood that they all interweave and support each other, it is understood that in some ways each one is kind of supporting the next. And then the next one actually supports and cultivates further the previous one. So there's a kind of a back and forth interweaving of these. So this positioning of energy after wisdom to some extent speaks of the direction of our energy. This quality of energy, the Pali term is virya, and translated variously as energy, courage, strength. And in and of itself, energy, we do just have the energy of life, the energy of being alive. And in and of itself, energy can be directed towards anger, desire, aggression, violence on the one hand, or directed towards love, generosity, wisdom, balance of mind. And so energy itself in our life is kind of neutral. So it is informed by our intention, by our direction. So this placement of energy after wisdom, I think, speaks to, for our practice, energy needs to be fueled by, supported by a wise direction. So what are we trying to do with our energy? How are we using our energy? These are important questions to explore. It's said that after the Buddha's awakening, he kind of surveyed the world with his mind, and in a poignant realization, recognized that people really want to be happy. That's a kind of an orientation. We want happiness in our lives. And yet, from the perspective of his new understanding of freedom, he saw that the way people go about finding happiness is actually exactly the thing that keeps them tied to their struggles. And so we apply our energy in the hope of being happy. And yet, there are ways of going about that that simply tie us to our habitual struggles. Our usual worldview, kind of in a simplified way perhaps, is, and this is the worldview I think the Buddha saw most people engaged in, is that having things will make me happy, or having people see me in a certain way will make me happy. So essentially looking for happiness in things outside of us, putting our reliance on happiness in creating certain conditions in the world, or in convincing people to see us in a certain way. And these very things that we are relying on for happiness, this kind of speaks to our first evening when we spoke about what do we take refuge in. So often we take refuge in things, in having a certain status or certain job. We take refuge in that. But the things and the opinions of other people that we take refuge in, those things are not reliable. Inherently, our material things are not permanent. They don't last. Many times things we are relying on are vanishing almost as soon as we're acquiring them. And certainly if we look at our own minds for even a day or two, as we've done here, we see just how changeable our own minds are, and so how reliable are the opinions of others on which to base our happiness? And so the perspective the Buddha offered us, from his own experience, he offers us this, a possibility for a kind of happiness, a kind of freedom, ease, peace in our lives that's not dependent on the circumstances in the world, not dependent on what we acquire or how people see us or what's happening, but is based in the ability of our hearts to remain unshaken by the conditions of the world. And by unshaken here, it doesn't mean unfeeling. That word unshakability at this point, as I'm thinking about it, you know, unshakable meaning rooted, not tossed about by, perhaps, something like that. So whatever's happening in the world, there's a way in which there can be a stability in our hearts and minds. And yet, something about the flexibility or the fluidity of heart that is non-reactive, to me it almost feels like it jiggles, but it doesn't shatter. So that when a heart that is non-reactive or non-agitated by the world meets suffering in the world, that heart is not thrown off by that suffering, but it like resonates with that suffering, and the response of that heart that's resonating with suffering is compassion. a beautiful quality of mind. And so while this quality of equanimity or balance of mind is a kind of a rootedness and unshakability, there's a way in that unshakable heart still resonates with the world. So it's not just unfeeling. And when that heart meets joy and success, someone delighting in their accomplishments, it also resonates with that joy. And so the direction of our practice, or where we place our energy or what we orient to, is exploring the possibility of finding our way to that unshakable heart, that heart that can resonate rather than shatter or clench, contract. And so the kind of framework that is offered in the Buddhist path is looking at what is it that leads us towards suffering, struggle, reactivity, confusion, and what is it that leads us away from that? What leads us towards peace, towards ease, towards this heart that can resonate with the world rather than clench around the world? Now, the framing of the teachings that the Buddha offered, the first teaching that it said that he offered, was the Four Noble Truths. These teachings, they can be stated as truths: the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the end of suffering, the truth of the path leading to the end of suffering. They can also be understood as practices, as actions, as directions for our life. In this first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, he suggested that we need to understand suffering, not in kind of an intellectual way, but in an experiential way. What is this experience of being a human being that is suffering? That's what he was pointing to. Understand how suffering comes to be. Understand the human experience of suffering. Know that from the inside, not from the perspective of how can I get rid of this, how can I fix the world, how can I fix myself, how can I get myself out of here, how can I make sure somebody else is out of here, but this is the experience of fear, of anxiety, of confusion, of anger, of hatred. There's a vast difference between seeing that as an experience, seeing, understanding, this is anger that's arising, and being angry and acting out of anger. These are vastly different things. The one leads on to further suffering. The other creates the conditions for wisdom, understanding, and freedom from that very suffering. So this Four Noble Truths, he suggests that we understand suffering, let go of its cause, realize the possibility of freedom, and cultivate the path. So the teaching is oriented around really understanding suffering and how we can be free of it. Much of the understanding that grows as we explore our own suffering is that we begin to see that certain qualities of heart and mind, are main contributors to the suffering. And other qualities of heart and mind support us to move in the other direction. So we could say some qualities, some states of mind are helpful in terms of leading us away from suffering. And other states or qualities of mind are not helpful in terms of leading us away from suffering. The basic qualities of mind that lead us toward suffering are rooted in greed, aversion, delusion. These are states like anger, hatred, restlessness, boredom, lust for power or money, despair, aversion, anger. And again, it's not so much about not having these states, but having a different relationship with these states. When these states are acted on from our usual perspective, from the habitual perspective of frustration means I need to fix something or figure something out, rather than, okay, this is the experience of frustration. The frustration in that way tends to create the conditions for more frustration. Now again, you know, I often have to really emphasize this because so often it can sound like the Buddhist path means that you never act if you're feeling frustration or anger. And that if there's injustice in the world, we simply sit there and notice our anger. But that's not actually what the orientation is, because I think we have this misunderstanding often that if there's some kind of injustice in the world, if we're not angry, it means we don't care. And we often also have the sense that, why would I act if I wasn't angry? And so the teaching of the Buddha again points us to a really different perspective on our experience. He looked out at the world and saw suffering. And he just didn't just sit under his tree the rest of his life. He thought about it. But he decided he needed to act to support people in the understanding that will free them from the suffering that he saw. And in his life, he took action. He went and stood on a battlefield trying to stop a water war. He was not a passive person. My understanding is that his motivation for action came from compassion and wisdom, not from anger, hatred, aversion, or desire, greed, or from confusion. So this is a really different perspective for us. So the exploration is to begin to understand how these qualities of heart and mind, based in greed, aversion, and delusion, these create suffering, not only in the world, but in ourselves. Create contraction, create pain, create constriction. And a constricted heart is not as easily able to navigate the world, not as able to respond with wisdom. So this direction the Buddha is offering us is one of wise responsiveness rather than our usual reactivity. And so we begin to try to orient our whole life towards recognizing, understanding these unhelpful states, and seeing if we can orient towards helpful states, states based in, it said, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. These are states like wisdom, compassion, generosity, love. And so these are the helpful states of mind. Sometimes we call these helpful states wholesome or skillful qualities of mind, the unhelpful states unwholesome or unskillful qualities of mind. And this orientation is kind of what the path of our energy, like this is the suggestion, energy should be directed towards seeing if we can release and let go of unhelpful qualities and cultivate helpful qualities. So this is the direction for our energy. One of the most connected practices around energy. There's several qualities that support energies coming into being. And we all have energy. I mean, there's energy in our system. Again, maybe kind of that neutral energy. And what we're exploring is how do we orient that energy in the direction of cultivating the skillful and the direction of letting go of the unskillful. Now, there's several practices or tools to support orienting our energy in this way. And one of these is the teaching on wise effort. Effort and energy are often, I think, maybe often even confused or equated, let's say. They're sometimes equated, effort and energy. But effort is my understanding of what effort is. Effort is how we use our energy. We need certain amount of energy to make effort. And so we have a certain amount of energy, and then we choose to direct it in a certain way. And so we make effort based on a certain amount of energy. And we've all got a certain amount of energy just sitting here being alive. Life comes with energy. So here we have this energy, and how do we choose to direct it? So the teaching on wise effort is pointing us in a direction. Make your effort this way. Try this. And the interesting result of that, making wise effort, there's another place in the teachings where the Buddha describes this quality of energy as being the result of making wise effort. And so energy results from effort. That's a little more counterintuitive. We think that making effort uses up energy. We've got a certain store of energy, and if we use it, it goes away, and then we have to do something to replenish it, like sleep or space out or, I don't know, do things that we do to rest in some way. But here, the teaching is pointing us to, if we make effort in this way, it generates energy. It generates this skillful energy. And so what is this teaching on wise effort? It's directly connected to these understanding these helpful and unhelpful qualities. As a list maker, the Buddha offered us four kinds of wise effort. Two of them connected to the unhelpful qualities. that we should explore avoiding, or what might it mean to make effort towards the non-arising of these unhelpful qualities, and also to the letting go when unhelpful qualities are present, the letting go or releasing or abandoning. So the formal statements of these two, first one sounds a little convoluted, the effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. Three negatives in that sentence. Think about that one. We'll talk about it in a minute. Then the effort towards the abandoning of unwholesome states that have arisen. On the wholesome side, there's the effort towards arousing or bringing into being those wholesome states that are not there yet. And the effort towards the maintaining of wholesome states that are there, that are arising for us. So this very definition of right effort includes this perspective of wisdom that the Buddha offered us, this perspective of, you know, suffering. Suffering is created by these unhelpful states. And so if there's movement that we can make in our with our energy towards releasing, letting go of, supporting the non-arising of those unhelpful states, that's going to help us become happier. That's what's going to help us become more truly happy. And effort towards the arising and maintaining of these beautiful states, that will help us to be happy. That will help us to let go, to have suffering be released in our lives. So this very definition of wise effort includes wisdom. And so wisdom and energy in this practice are intimately connected. We apply our energy from the perspective of wisdom. So this first one, the effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. Basically, this is so you're in a place where, you know, there's not much going on. What might it mean to, we recognize through mindfulness, through watching our minds, what conditions, what situations, what circumstances lead us into struggle, into suffering, and explore what it means to let go or not go there, to avoid that direction, to avoid that suffering. So in first glance, this might sound like, you know, this avoiding that we're talking about, you know, so avoiding the arising of unhelpful states, it can have a subtle meaning. At first glance, we might think, you know, we notice, for instance, we go to the dining room each day and we begin recognizing that whenever we're in the line with other people, that comparing and judging comes up in our minds. And being mindful, being aware of what's going on, we feel the suffering of that judgment. That's actually, it's helpful actually to know that comparing and judging are suffering. That's the first lesson we get. If we're not paying attention with mindfulness, we might think that comparing and judging are just the way things are and that we should act on them. Tell people, oh, you shouldn't do this, or you should do that. Or, oh, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. But instead, here we are, we're noticing. We notice, oh, this is suffering. So that's one of the first lessons we get. So we're standing in the line and we see, oh, suffering arises when we stand in the line and comparing and judging happens. At first glance, we might think, okay, the lesson of this first kind of wise effort means I shouldn't go and get in the line when there are other people in the line. I should wait until nobody is in the line. Go to the very end. I hang out in the meditation hall for another 15 minutes. I go through the line. There's nobody there. It's not suffering. That's great. That's one way to deal with it. And yet, you're not really addressing or getting curious about the underlying stuff that's going on there. And so another way to explore what this means, this avoiding, is basically, so you're in the line. You're in the line and you notice that suffering. So first of all, you've noticed it. You've seen, oh, this is suffering. Get curious about what comparing and judging is about. It's not simply caused by being in a line. There's something going on in the mind that's creating comparing and judging. What's happening there? So curiosity about that in the first place. That's one, especially when you see that it's already there. You know, this is really the second kind of wise effort, what to do when we see suffering that's already there. Another way to explore this in a, you know, kind of a, it's in a way a tool or a technique to begin to recognize, you know, as you go into the lunch line. I mean, one of the conditions for the arising of that judgment is that you're seeing things, you're seeing people, you're having ideas about what they're doing. You're having ideas in comparison to what you're doing. And so all of that stuff's going on. So one of the ways you might explore this would be you go into the dining hall and just start recognizing that seeing is happening. Seeing. Joseph Goldstein recommends this as a practice because so many, I think if we could see little thought bubbles over our heads in the dining room, there'd be a lot of comparing and judging going on. So if you can just know that seeing is happening, landing with mindfulness with seeing, in a way, this is a way of it kind of can short circuit the movement towards the judging, because you're really clearly aware that the seeing is happening. The judging arises partly because we see something, we think about it, and we have not been aware that that's gone on. And because of that, our habitual tendencies, whatever they are, towards greed, aversion, confusion, arise, and our thoughts proliferate into judging, comparing. So if we can be mindful, oh, seeing is happening. That creates the conditions for the non-arising of the judging and the comparing. So avoiding unwholesome states can have a subtle meaning. It doesn't mean just simply not have those kinds of conversations or not go to those places, but be curious about what's happening, seeing if you can be mindful of the whole process by which something arises. As we're more and more mindful of the whole process by which something unfolds, the mind begins to reorient towards letting go of the unhelpful and orient towards the helpful. This is one of the magic things about our practice. It's a beautiful thing about our practice. It's basically partly because our systems, our organisms, want to move towards well-being. And when our system, our organism, gets the information that something in our own minds is leading us towards suffering, our organism recognizes, oh, that's not helpful. It begins to release it. It begins to gravitate slowly. It's not like one time you see this and suddenly, boom, you're not reacting anymore. But slowly the mind begins to gravitate in a more helpful direction. So the second kind of right effort is the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. This is so much of our practice. These unwholesome states, these unhelpful states, are a lot of these reactive mind states. So many of you in the meetings today were talking about seeing reactivity, frustration, fear, confusion, anxiety, restlessness, sleepiness, dullness, all of these states where there's a feeling of, don't want it to be like this. So the exploration around this kind of wise effort is, The word is to abandon. And again, it may sound like we should do something active. Oh, there's anger arising. I should not have anger arising. I should be able to turn off anger, abandon it. That's what they say. Leave it. Good luck with that. I wish there were a switch we could flip when we saw an unwholesome state that said, oh, that's not helpful. Okay, I can stop doing that. Our minds are very deeply conditioned in the direction of many of these unhelpful states. And so simply noticing them is usually not going to have us be able to stop them. We may try, and we often do, I think, try to repress them. And we feel like, oh, don't do that. Stop doing that. But what's that doing? It's just adding another layer of aversion to something that's happening in our minds. And so much of our practice is more about this, what I said earlier, that vast difference between buying into a state of mind, of anger or confusion or frustration, and just following it, versus knowing this is what it is to be a human being that's angry. This, we could say this is kind of a letting be. Can we open to and know this is the human experience of being in this state? This is so much of our practice. And again, it creates the conditions for the heart and mind to begin to understand and learn something about that reactivity, and to allow it to begin to weaken and loosen it all through that understanding, the wisdom that comes from being willing to meet those difficult states without judgment, without repression, and without buying into. This is the middle way that the Buddha talked about. Neither repressing or buying into and following, but opening to. This really allows us to sit with dignity with whatever is happening for us. We don't have to push anything away. And we also don't have to feel like we're somehow being pulled along by those things either. This possibility of standing in the middle of our difficult experience. So this is so much of our work with this second kind of wise effort, that we open to with mindfulness to these difficult states. At other times, it's possible and even helpful to actively take some action to support letting go. I usually suggest, if it's possible to be there with mindfulness with a difficult state of mind, that's probably the most helpful thing to do in that moment. If you can watch it and be curious about it, there's more learning happening there that will ultimately free the heart and mind and head the heart in the direction of letting go of that state on its own. Not with the having to fix things or change things, but the heart understands how to let it go. Wisdom understands how to let it go. But there are times when we see that something has such a hold on us that it is helpful to take some kind of action. So if there's some difficult state arising, there's some tools or techniques that can help us. If you find it's difficult to be mindful of it, and I usually like to suggest you try mindfulness. If you find that being mindful of a reactive state of mind ends up basically pulling you into the rabbit hole of that state, probably not so helpful to just try pure mindfulness with that. So discernment here, again, energy supported by wisdom. discernment. What's helpful here? Pure mindfulness, it's like the mindfulness gets pulled into the gravitational hole of that state of mind. It disappears. So, some tools for this. One that the Buddha suggested is start thinking about something else. Put some different thoughts in your mind. Just replace the thoughts with some other thoughts. That's kind of a first level. Another tool would be to actively choose to not pay attention to whatever it is that's leading to that reactivity. So, you know, we could call this skillful distraction. And some of you have talked about this, and there are definitely times when this is like one of the most helpful things to do, skillfully distract yourself. And here, the kinds of distractions we can cultivate, and what I would say skillful distraction is turning the attention to something other than the reactivity is about and being mindful of that. So if you're noticing that there's reactivity coming up in your mind about some thoughts that you're having, kind of pulled into thoughts of the past and anxiety and what happened a couple of weeks ago and how do I figure this out, you find your mind gravitating to that over and over again and the emotions related to that, it might be useful to, when you notice those thoughts arising, if you've seen that the mind just gets pulled into the rabbit hole of that reactivity, open your eyes, go out into nature. I sometimes call this changing the channel. Put your attention on something else. Let yourself mindfully do seeing. One of the most helpful tools for this I call useless gazing. We can all try it here for a few seconds. So the technique is that you look at something for about a second. And when I'm doing it in a room like this, I pick corners. And so look at something for about a second. And then switch and look at something else. And then switch and look at something else. And then switch. And switch. And it's helpful to move your head too. So we'll do this for about 10 more seconds. This tool helps to break the mind's kind of being pulled to something, because you're consciously breaking the pull by changing the focus. So that's a tool that's very useful when we're kind of stuck to something that's challenging. A third kind of right effort is moving in the direction of supporting and cultivating the wholesome states. So the effort to arouse wholesome states that have not arisen. So basically there's two explorations around this. There's we're doing this here with the practice of the precepts of non-harming, that we are cultivating wholesome states by connecting to practices that help us oppose the opposite qualities of mind. And so we cultivate non-harming. We cultivate wise speech. We cultivate skillful use of our energy and non-harming use of our energy. And this supports the cultivation of wholesome states by avoiding going towards the unwholesome, unhelpful states. And then we can also actively cultivate wholesome states. We can orient our minds towards perhaps the quality of generosity, as Greg talked about last night, that we can practice what it means to be generous. We can practice what it means to be kind. We can choose to engage in our actions, perhaps, even if we're not necessarily feeling it. At one point in my practice, I was looking at cultivating patience. And what I saw so much was impatience. And so I began exploring the possibility of, even if I was feeling impatient, to act as though I were patient. So I found myself in a drugstore one day, throwing things into my basket. I was impatient. I was just wanting to get through the store. And I saw the actions of my body, and I was just really throwing things into my basket, and I recognized that the actions of my body were a reflection of the impatience in my mind. And so I decided to pick up a practice of acting as though I were patient. And so still not repressing, so this is important, not repressing the impatience, clearly feeling, knowing, yep, there's impatience here, I started picking things up very carefully and placing them slowly into my basket. I slowed down a little bit. Within about a minute, patience was present. So we can sometimes do really simple things that orient us in the direction of wholesome qualities. Now again, this is a kind of middle way. I didn't repress the impatience. That would not have been, if I were repressing the impatience when I was doing that, I think the impatience just would have strengthened. So I was like, okay, yep, this is impatience. And I'm going to just do this really slowly. Bodies and minds have a feedback loop. And so we can support the cultivation of some wholesome qualities by modeling or acting as though they were present. There's one teaching I love from, a paraphrase teaching from one of my favorite texts of the Buddha. If you want to cultivate peace, act peacefully. So through our practice of mindfulness, already we're cultivating the wholesome quality of mindfulness. Right there. We're cultivating patience for meeting difficult qualities. We're cultivating the wisdom about understanding what this is in the moment instead of reacting to it. Wisdom. So many beautiful qualities are cultivated as we turn with mindfulness to our experience. So this is a way of supporting the arising of wholesome states. And the fourth, the effort to maintain or sustain wholesome states that have arisen. When I thought about this one at first, when I was first learning about these, I thought, well, why would you need to work on that? I mean, if there's something beautiful arising, why would I have to work on maintaining it? And then I began looking at my mind. And one day I was sitting at my table having breakfast and feeling kind of a surprise. I was just being present and, you know, eating my breakfast. And at some point, all this joy began arising. And to my surprise, it was like, wow, I don't know how to be with this. I don't know how to be present with this. So sometimes it can take us by surprise, but sometimes it does take some amount of effort or exploration to allow wholesome states, to allow beautiful states to be fully expressed in us. Not only for themselves, you know, as I experienced with joy, you know, it's like the experience of joy was so overwhelming. It's like, I thought, I can't handle this. It's too intense. Fortunately, a little bit of wisdom flitted into my mind at that point and said, it's okay, it's impermanent, it'll pass. And with that, it's like, okay, it'll go away, so let's see what happens if I stop resisting it. And it got really strong. It was like, whoa, it got really strong for a few moments, and then it was like, whew, it was like a wave that broke. And then there was more just a sense of happy peacefulness on the other side, and that was, that I could like linger with. So this was a little bit of a cultivation of exploring the possibility of being with wholesome states. Sometimes I found another way that my mind circumvents staying with wholesome states is it thinks, well, here was another example. I was at the 3-month course at IMS, and I don't know, a month in, I'm really starting to notice a lot of calm arising. And at one morning, I was sitting there, I was like, oh, calm. Oh, that's calm. And what my mind did with that was like, oh, well, there's calm. This is the perfect time to pay attention to that back pain then. You know, the thing that would probably be, you know, the thing that would take me into reactivity. It's almost like the mind wanted to get reactive. You know, so this is again a way that our minds may habitually orient away from wholesome states. And so, oh, there's calm present. What does that mean? What does it mean to be present with calm? One of the most helpful ways to explore the maintaining of wholesome states that have arisen is to be mindful of them, to know that they're there. This is the experience of happiness. This is the human experience of joy. This is the human experience of calm. Not, oh good, I'm so great that I've got this calm, or oh, I'm a good meditator that I finally, you know, felt all this joy. But this is the experience of calm, of peace, of bliss. One of the most helpful ways is mindfulness. And actually, you know, sometimes in talking about these wise efforts, people have the question or the concern or the confusion. It's like, okay, you know, in mindfulness, we talk about with mindfulness, just notice what's arising. Just be with what's arising. And so how does that relate to avoiding unwholesome states that haven't arisen and abandoning wholesome states that have arisen and maintaining and cultivating and supporting the arising of wholesome states? How does it connect? When we are exploring mindfulness of anything, when we're exploring mindfulness of a reactive state, the four right efforts are happening. As we open our attention to anger, for example, with mindfulness in this way of, oh, this is the human experience of anger. It creates the conditions for wisdom to support the releasing of that anger, the second wise effort. It actually supports in the future that less anger will tend to arise. Partly because we get really clearly that anger is suffering. And as we really get that, it's like our system recognizes, oh, that way lies suffering. As we explore anger with mindfulness, we're cultivating the wholesome quality of mindfulness. We're cultivating the wholesome quality of concentration and equanimity and patience. All of the paramis are being cultivated as we turn our attention with mindfulness. So we're well in the side of wise effort there as well. So wise mindfulness encompasses these wise efforts. And there are times, as I said earlier, that sometimes mindfulness isn't strong enough to meet some of those difficulties. And so we need to use some other tools. And that's fine. We use wisdom, discernment, to know that. One of the greatest supports for this wise energy is curiosity. If we can have the perspective of, again, coming back to that question of what is it to be a human being that is experiencing this? Can we be curious about it? James Baraz offers this fun way into this curiosity. He said that he would play with this. He said, I pretended like I was an alien. I had been sent down from the mothership to take up residence in a human body. So there I am, inside the human body. And my job is to report back to the mothership what it's like to be a human being. This is what it feels like when they feel anger. This is what it feels like when they feel confusion. This is what it feels like when they feel bliss. This is what it feels like when they feel happy. Can we have this perspective of curiosity? What is it to be a human? We live in human bodies, and yet we are not so curious about it. This curiosity is a great support for this. And patience. This is the next parami in the list. It's interesting to me that energy is surrounded by wisdom and patience. Because patience is necessary to keep going. Just persistence to be present, to have that curiosity. And so wisdom, energy, patience supports our landing here and beginning to understand from the inside for ourselves the truth of this new perspective around what's helpful and not helpful in our lives with respect to becoming really basically happy. This is really what the Buddha was pointing to. Happiness is possible. Peace is possible, but not in the way that we've thought it was. So energy towards realizing that possibility, that direction for ourselves. Let's just sit for a minute.